Welcome. It's my pleasure to introduce Mike Van Quickenborn, and tonight he's, it's 4 o'clock. This afternoon, he's going to share the good game on the moral value of sports. So thank you, Mike.
Okay.
I'll shut the door.
All right, thanks. Yeah. Thanks for coming out. So just a couple things, a little bit different. I did a presentation Monday and Tuesday. This one's going to be a bit different. The two presentations before this and then one on Friday are all about film and philosophy. This is a different sort of beast. I actually will have, if you were here on Monday, I showed some clips from the film Waking Life. There's going to be another clip from Waking Life here as well. So, you know, get a little bit, piece all the movie together, I guess, if you keep coming. This presentation is one I prepared for Humanities Washington. I'm part of their speakers bureau, and just say a couple things. I'm kind of supposed to say a couple things about them. If you are from Washington State, I guess you know might pay particular attention. If you're not, come back and visit soon. But basically, they have a speakers bureau, and they have more than 30 people who they have kind of organized, and libraries, museums, theaters, retirement homes, just organizations around Washington State can go to their website, humanities.org, and look at their, sort of all the different speakers, and then have them come. And Humanities Washington pays for the speakers' speaking fees, what they call, and then the host organization just has to be responsible for somehow getting them there. So it's a great organization, and again, if you're in Washington State, I encourage you to go to their website, humanities.org. Another great website, is that website there. This website is specifically geared toward my topic for today, dealing with sports and ethics. And so you can go there. Mostly what you'll find there is a bibliography. Maybe there's some films referenced. But anyway, a bibliography dealing with sports and ethics. So you can check that out if you like at some point. All right, so I'll just say a couple things about myself here, just to kind of give you a sense of where I'm coming from with this topic. I have taught philosophy at Everett Community College since the 20th century. I like putting it that way. It makes me seem very old. I was briefly a water polo coach where I live currently in Anacortes, and I swam and played water polo collegiately at St. Olaf College. You can know about St. Olaf around here. But I grew up in the San Francisco Bay Area, and rooting for the 49ers in the era of Joe Montana and Jerry Rice. Okay, so that also dates me. I love watching the Olympics when they come around, but I have to admit I do feel guilty about it because I know that it's not necessarily a good thing for the host countries when they host the Olympics. And I know that if anybody ever kind of started generating enthusiasm for hosting the Olympics in the Seattle area, I would be amongst those who would say, no, not us, send it somewhere else. But anyway, I still like watching them. I'm going to talk a little bit about esports at the end, which is why I'm making reference here to video games. So my favorite Christmas present as a child, without compare, was an Atari 2600, if you know what that is. But I don't own an Xbox, so I mean, I used to be into video games much more today. I don't have the time. I have two small children. I don't have the time. So, as with all of my presentations this week, please ask questions, offer comments at any time. You're not interrupting me. In fact, I will be asking you questions today. It'll be fairly interactive, at least I hope so. I'm going to begin here by telling you a story about these two softball teams. Okay, and this story took place in Ellensburg, Washington, central Washington, not too far away, in the year 2008. And it was early May, and the softball team from Central Washington University, which you can see there, the Wildcats, they were taking on the Wolves of Western Oregon University in a game that would determine if the Wildcats would get to advance to the playoffs. And so I'm going to share now with you a report from CBS News. Here it is. With two runners on base and a strike against her, Sarah Tucholsky of Western Oregon University uncorked her best swing and did something she had never done in high school or college. She hit her first home run, which cleared the center field fence. But it looked like the shortest of dreams come true when she missed first base, started back to tag it, and collapsed with a knee injury. She crawled back to first, but could do no more. The first base coach said she would be called out if her teammates tried to help her. Or, the umpire said, a pinch runner could be called in and the homer would count as just a single. Then, members of the Central Washington University softball team stunned their home crowd in Ellensburg. Central Washington first baseman Mallory Holtman
the all-time home run leader in the Great Northwest Athletic Conference, asked the umpire if she and her teammates could help Tucholsky. The umpire said there was no rule against it. So Holtman and shortstop Liz Wallace put their arms under Tucholsky's legs, and she put her arms over their shoulders. The three headed around the base paths, stopping to let Tucholsky touch each base with her good leg, so the three-run homer would count, an act that contributed to their own elimination from the playoffs. Holtman was interviewed for CBS News' Early Show, where she said, quote, "It was the right thing to do. She'd hit it over the fence. She deserved the home run. In the end, it is not about winning and losing so much. It was about this girl. She hit it over the fence and was in pain, and she deserved a home run." Now, if you're like me, I think you probably found that to be a wonderful example of not only how sports can move us emotionally, but also the fact that sports lay claim to playing an important role in developing and exemplifying moral values. Furthermore, given their outsized impact on our culture, it's imperative to reflect on to what extent they are worthy of our time, attention, and financial means. So, as I said, I'm a philosopher. I teach philosophy at Everett Community College. And in fact, philosophers have not turned their attention to sports very long, basically only since the early 1970s. And I honestly think this has been a great oversight on our part. It's clear that, I've longed for this number, but I've done some sort of back-of-the-napkin calculations. And according to what I could figure out, it's clear that every year in the United States alone, hundreds of billions of dollars and countless hours are spent viewing, discussing, and participating in sports. Now, you might be thinking that, oh yeah, exactly, we spend too much time and money on sports. And I would agree that sports can be the focus of too much of our energies. By the way, that's true of any pursuit, including philosophy. Okay. I would also argue, though, that to not thoughtfully engage with sports is a mistake, again, especially given how much we put into sports. So let me just share here quickly with you a quote from the philosopher Leslie Howe. She's at the, last I checked, University of Saskatchewan. She says that sports reflect who we are at a particularly deep level, and they serve as a vitally important medium in shaping our personal and cultural identities. And, you know, that's one of the reasons I love this story, for a lot of reasons, but especially because it connects nearly all of the themes in my presentation today. That story exemplifies the virtues that are uniquely developed by sport, such as how to face danger and how to form a community that is both internally supportive and still open to others. It also illustrates the role of competition, what it's good for, and its limits, making clear that the proper attitude is not to win at all costs. It also shows what fans can get out of viewing a sport, especially inspiration and respect for opponents. So I think all of those themes are reflected in that story, but I'm going to tack another one on the end of my presentation, kind of looking at the future of sports. Because in addition to those topics, I want to look at esports, and namely what we might make of them. I say that, let me just check in with you here real quick. Is anybody in here not a familiar with or have heard, having, has anyone not ever heard of esports? Everybody has heard of esports. Okay, maybe not. Okay, a couple of you have it. So,
do you mean like video game sports, or do you mean like dreaming of being on teams and things like that?
Video game sports. Okay. So people who play video games in competitions, and at this point can fill Key Arena in downtown Seattle and can, you know, get tens of thousands of dollars of prize money. And, you know, I don't know what your definition of sports is. We're going to talk about that in a minute. But if it's whatever ESPN covers, then it's a sport. Okay, because ESPN now covers esports. We'll look at that in more detail at the end of the presentation. So so that kind of leads me to the next point, though. As is often the case in philosophy, we really need to begin by understanding the very terms at stake. In this case, that's the definition, the very definition of this word, sport itself. Again, sports, I think we could agree, are highly revered in our culture and others around the world. And so it's really important to ask ourselves, what is it that makes something a sport in the first place? And so to kind of get us to think about that, I'm going to have a couple of quizzes for you today, because I'm an instructor, so that's what I do. And so we're going to play a little quiz here about dealing with what is a sport. So I'm going to show you some pictures here, and you tell me, is that a sport?
Yes.
Okay, I think mostly you'll... I'm going to start off easy, right? Okay, yeah, that's a sport. Seattle Seahawks there. Is that a sport?
Yes.
course. All right. So what you're seeing there looks like the Swedish Verizon Storm versus the DraftKings Verizon Liberty. No, I'm just kidding. But anyway, this is WNBA players here from Seattle and New York. All right. Sport.
Yes.
World champion Seattle Sounders there. It'll get more difficult. Okay, sport?
Yeah.
Sport?
Kind of.
Ah, okay. First, a questionable thing. Golf? I don't know. Who's that? John Daly, I believe. Yeah. Okay. There we go. Sport?
Yes.
Yeah. Sport? Okay, one person's nodding vigorously, but others are saying no, right? Okay, so that's good, right? Teach philosophy. I like it when we disagree. Some differences here. I'm not going to tell you what the correct definition of a sport is, but it's good to think about those differences and why we might say the activity on the left is a sport and maybe the one in the upper right-hand corner is not, perhaps. But you can decide for yourself. And let's see, I think I have one more here. Yeah, there he is. Sport.
No. E-sport? Is that an
example? Well, I will tell you that person is, he has a scholarship to Robert Morris University to play, what is it? I don't know, World of Warcraft or something. I'm not, again, a video gamer, but World of Warcraft for the college and compete against other universities, and he has a scholarship to do so.
Wow. Sport.
Right? No. Some of you should be writing this down. I need to go to Robert. No, anyway. So again, some differences. Some people are saying no, some yes. So we'll continue to think about this and see what we want to come to believe maybe by the end of this. So I'll revisit esports again at the end of today's presentation. So again, what is a sport? I've just given you some things to think about there. Let me give you a couple of definitions that have been offered by philosophers. He's actually Richard Mandel, a historian. So Richard Mandel defines sport as, quote, competitive activity of the whole human body according to sets of rules for purposes ostensibly or symbolically set apart from the serious essential aspects of life. So there's one attempt at a definition. On the other hand, Bernard Suits, a Canadian philosopher, merely says that sport is a game which must involve physical skill, it must be stable. What he means by that stable is, have like some sort of organization around it, right? So like the NFL, obviously makes footballs have an institution surrounding it and so forth. Have a wide following. Again, like National Football League has a wide following, so it's clearly a sport. And then also whatever is involved in that activity must be admirable, quote unquote. Okay, so a couple definitions, clearly not the same. And so, just to get us to think about this, which definition do you think is better, do you agree with more?
Mandel.
Yeah?
Well, the problem with the second one is admirable is subjective.
Uh-huh, okay. It's subjective, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah?
Yeah, I have a problem with the second one with the wide following.
You think that's questionable?
That is questionable.
Yeah. Well, right, so there's, like you say, subjective, and then wide, what's a wide following, right? It's a bit vague. Okay, good.
I'm interpreting the admirable, but you're not trying to physically hurt or kill someone.
Yes.
So I'm wondering if that's where that came in.
So are you saying that that makes the second definition questionable? That is, there are...
It's better. I liked it, but I was, only looking at it one way.
Yeah. Yeah. I'll share with you, to be honest, I kind of prefer the second one. In that first definition, I have a couple questions here. First of all, as I'll make mention here in a couple minutes, that word competitive is in the first definition, not in the second, right? And I do think that there are sports that don't have to involve competition. I think that's a separate thing that, yeah, some sports are, some may not be. I also wonder, in that first definition, he talks about how it has to involve the whole human body, right? But just... 2 minutes ago, we all said that the wheelchair basketball players were involved in a sport, and they're not using their whole body, right? And I would be, with you in saying that that is a sport. So I do think that sports don't necessarily have to involve the whole human body. So I have some affinity to the second one, but I certainly understand those questions you had about, well, what does it really mean to be admirable? What does it mean to have a wide following? And I think those are definitely good questions to ask. So I will just say that we'll come back to this, especially suits' definition later when we're thinking about a variety of other sports here.
Can I ask, like, what sport do you say is not competitive? Because everything I can think of is competitive.
I have a slide in a couple minutes. I'm going to share several examples, but this isn't one of them. So I'll just tell you that, and it's on the kiosk, you know, in terms of, like I mentioned, I play water polo and so forth. Where I live in Anacortes is great mountain biking territory, so I like to ride my mountain bike. And, I mean, I consider that a sport. I'm not competing with anybody. And
but there are competitions.
There are competitions. And when I hear about those, I say I'm not doing that, and because that's I just don't have that interest, you know. But yet I still think I'm participating in a sport when I do that, just as an example. But again, I'm not saying that's the right way to think of it. Other people might say, well, what you're doing is not a sport; it's exercise, it's being in nature or something like that. And yeah, maybe that is the case, but I would call it a sport. But I'll give some other examples in a minute. Thank you for your contributions here and questions. So. Let me just say, why I'm going to try and motivate why I think this is an important topic. Again, many philosophers certainly haven't thought it's that important, and I think a lot of people kind of dismiss sports as being particularly important. But given the way the culture is today, I think that contemporary culture wants to tear humanity in a variety of directions, right? So first of all, there are places and situations where the society wants us to think of ourselves as purely just individuals, right? Little almost atomistic elements of society, and we're out to make a place in the world for ourselves, and it's more of a capitalistic sort of view of things. We're just these individuals competing against many others. On the other hand, other parts of society or in other places in the world treat human beings as just members of a collective, right? So I imagine, for example, I have all this expensive Apple gear all over here, and we all know where this stuff was made. It was made in factories, in China, and the people who work in those factories, from what I understand, are not encouraged to think of themselves as individuals. They're encouraged to think of themselves as sort of, part of the factory machinery almost, right? Part of the collective effort to make these products. Kind of with that in mind, there are forces in the world that encourage us to think of ourselves as just a body, right? And so again, if you go back to, agriculture or working in a factory, people in those settings are not valued for their mind in any way. They're valued for what they can do in terms of their labor. On the other hand, we have perhaps closer to home here, in Seattle, we have a lot of people working in programming, at Microsoft, Amazon, and so forth. And they are valued, their body isn't really important. What they're valued for is just their mind. How can they put together a computer program in the most effective way? But as Mallory Holtman said in that story I shared with you a minute ago, that story was about this girl. It was about the whole person. It wasn't about her mind or her body. It was about the whole person. And I think this is one thing that is particularly valuable about sports. Sports involves whole persons because sports call on us to use both our body and our mind together. And there are a lot of places in this world where we're being pulled apart, and I think we ought to be brought together, body and mind, because both are, I think, very valuable. To kind of motivate that thought, I was going to show here a clip. It's just a couple minutes from the film Waking Life. There's a lot to say about this film. I said some of it on Monday. But this is the philosopher David Sosa, who last I checked was at the University of Texas. And he's going to be talking about freedom, free will, essentially, right? How we make choices and why it's important to consider those questions. So let me show that and then I'll comment on it. I have to turn this up first.
Think about individuality, for example, who you are. Who you are is mostly a matter of the free choices that you make or take responsibility. You can only be held responsible, you can only be found guilty, or you can only be admired or respected for things you did of your own free will. The question keeps coming back, and we don't really have a solution to it. It starts to look like all your decisions are really just a charade. Think about how it happens. There's some electrical activity in your brain. Your neurons fire. They send a signal down into your nervous system. It passes along down into your muscle fibers. They twitch. You might, say, reach out your arm. It looks like it's a free action on your part. But every one of those, every part of that process is actually governed by physical law, chemical laws, electrical laws, and so on. So now it starts to look like the Big Bang set up the initial conditions, and the whole rest of our history, the whole rest of human history and moving forward, is really just sort of the playing out of subatomic particles according to these basic fundamental physical laws. We think we're special. We think we have some kind of special dignity. But that now comes under threat. I mean, that's really challenged by this picture. So you might be saying, well, wait a minute, what about quantum mechanics? I know enough contemporary physical theory to know it's not really like that. It's really a probabilistic theory. There's room, it's loose, it's not deterministic. And that's going to enable us to understand free will. But if you look at the details, it's not really going to help, because what happens is you have some very small quantum particles, and their behavior is apparently a bit random. They sort of swerve. Their behavior is absurd in the sense that it's unpredictable, and we can't understand it based on anything that came before. It just does something out of the blue, according to a probabilistic framework. But is that going to help with freedom? I mean, should our freedom just be a matter of probabilities, just some random swerving in a chaotic system? That starts to seem like it's worse. I'd rather be a gear in a big deterministic physical machine than just some random swerving. So we can't just ignore the problem. We have to find room in the contemporary worldview for persons, with all that entails, not just bodies, but persons. And that means trying to solve the problem of freedom, finding room for choice and responsibility, and trying to understand individuality.
So I feel like I should stop here and ask 30 questions about that, because it's weird, right? And he doesn't say anything about sports, but I'll try and connect that in a minute. But questions about that? What I think is important about that is, especially what he's saying there at the end, and saying that we need to find a place for persons in the world, and that we need to have, you know, be able to have personal responsibility. And he's talking about how the mind and the body interact in some way. And I think this is where sports is particularly valuable in our society, right? Because some athlete does some outstanding feat. We praise both their mind and their body, right? We praise their discipline in getting to that point where they're able to accomplish some feat. And of course, we also say that, you know, their body enabled them to do whatever feat it was. So it's a way to integrate both the mind and the body that I don't think we find necessarily in many other places in our culture. Especially as, again, we see that people are more involved with, say, computer industries and programming and service industries, right, emphasizing the mind. And then the other part of the world is all involved in doing our physical labor, cooking our food, picking our agriculture, picking our produce, and so forth. And so I think sports is a way to integrate both of those things. So that's why I want to share that with you. So the other thing we need to notice, is, of course, as I've already mentioned, is that sports are held in high esteem in our culture. And I think there's a good reason for that. I will argue that sports produce moral, valuable moral goods, and that these goods are in increasingly short supply in particular ways that I'll talk about here. I want to make it clear, because I know this argument has been made and can be made, but I'm not arguing in favor of sports for their health benefits, okay? I'm not saying, oh yes, we should all participate in sports because you're going to be healthier and live a longer life or something like this. First of all, because it's not necessarily true, right? And we've been hearing a lot about the danger of concussions, you know, lately with regard to football and other sports. And so sports may, in fact, not be a healthy thing, at least certain sports. So I'm not arguing in favor of sports for their health benefits. Even if sports had no health benefits, I think they would still be important pursuits, as I'll try and make the case. Also, I want to make it clear, because, you know, when we talk about sports, certain people think of athletes, right? You know, these perfect physical specimens. And they think, well, okay, somebody like that, of course, they will be involved in sports, or they ought to be involved in sports. But I want to emphasize that I think sports are also open to all body types, right? There are sumo wrestlers. They participate in sports. And they're about, you know, they're on one extreme, and the other extreme, I don't know, gymnasts, I guess I'm thinking of, right? And everywhere in between, there will be some kind of sport that somebody can do if they choose to do that. So I'm not having in my mind, when I talk about sports, this ideal physical specimen, because I think sports can appeal to and be an important part of anybody's life. Okay, so to get onto this moral value issue here, and to talk about ethics a bit, we'll talk about the virtues. There's a couple quotes here, at least one. Sports, as Albert Camus said, the existentialist philosopher, are that from which he learned all he knows about ethics. And, of course, sports are often brought up in connection with children, right? Children are heavily involved with sports much more than adults and others. And so I'm going to tie in here Aristotle, the ancient Greek philosopher, who preached, we might say, that we ought to train people to have good character and follow the virtues. So he said that men train the young for the formation of good moral character, and the virtues such as courage, honesty, generosity, etc. According to Aristotle, these are habits that become dispositions of character, right? So they become automatic ways of living your life. And so, children, I think, are often faced with important moral decisions for the first time in a sporting context, right? The decision to face some, you know, danger, at least in their mind, right? They have the opportunity to be honest. What, did the ball go out of bounds or not, right? They can decide, no, it didn't, and lie about it, or they can decide to be honest. And so they face these important moral decisions in that kind of context for the first time. And I think that by participating in sports, children practice the virtues then, right? Their coaches hopefully tell them, this is how you ought to behave, these are the important ways to participate in sport, and that they then can have these virtues ingrained in them. So, what are the virtues that can be gained by participating in sport? Well, of course, camaraderie, right? If you're part of a team or training with other people, if you can form camaraderie with these people. It can give you courage or opportunities to face danger. It can give you opportunities to be honest. It can give you an opportunity to understand what honor is about. And I think this is important, again, it, more and more so in our highly technological culture, sports provide us an opportunity to engage an essential part of ourselves, our animal self. And I think that everybody needs these opportunities, not just children. And as I just said, these opportunities, are, I think, are in shorter and shorter supply in our highly technological culture. Let me try and explain a little bit better here. So, where did all the danger go? Well, I'm not saying there's no danger in the world, right? But here, in the highly developed Western world, United States, we are less often in danger, right? We don't have to fear, well, okay, by the way, right? Mostly I give this talk in libraries around the state, right? I don't usually give this talk in wilderness areas. Okay. So yeah, there are bears, all right? We know about that, and maybe mountain lions and so forth. But in most parts of the world, you don't have to face the concern about being eaten by a bear, not that we're worried about that here. Or that, you know, there's gonna be some hazard that can endanger our lives. And so, when those infrequent, this is a good thing, by the way, right? When these infrequent opportunities to face danger come up, since if we don't participate in sports, we maybe never face any danger, we don't know how to respond to it. So it gives us an opportunity to practice. What do I do when I'm faced with danger? Similarly, I think in our highly technological culture, we have fewer temptations to cheat. So when we do, we don't know how to respond, right? I mean, this gets down to the level of, I know in certain parts of Puget Sound, right, they have red light cameras or stoplight cameras, right? So if you want to cheat, if you want to run the red light, you're going to get a ticket. If you want to be in the carpool lane with just by yourself, they have ways of finding out, I don't know, that you're by yourself in your car, and you will get a ticket. So we have fewer temptations to cheat. And so if we haven't faced those kinds of situations where we have an opportunity to cheat, we won't know how to respond in the proper way. And I think sports can give us those opportunities so we know, oh yes, I should be honest. I've been trained in being honest by participating in sports. All right. By the way, you can argue with anything I'm saying here, but this is my view of things. We have fewer opportunities to bond in our highly technological culture. Again, Holden Village, very much an exception, okay? We know that. But out there, outside of Holden Village, people have fewer opportunities to bond. People are much more engaged with one another over social media rather than face-to-face, let's say, right? This is a 21st century development. And so when we do get these opportunities to bond, we don't normally know how to do that. We haven't had practice in that. Of course, coming to Holden Village gives us a lot of practice in doing that as well. But sports can provide that for those people who aren't able to come to wonderful places like this and experience these kinds of bonding opportunities. Sports gives us an opportunity to engage each other physically, to actually physically touch, you know, and encounter people that we have fewer and fewer opportunities to do so in, again, the world today. Because many of us in the United States, we're not working, you know, in terms of labor, you know, next to somebody else picking strawberries like they do so often in Skagit Valley and so forth. There are, of course, people who do fit into that category, but many people in our culture don't. And so for those who don't, sports can provide an opportunity to actually physically, you know, be next to somebody and understand how their body works and how you might interact with them in a physical way. So I think that sports can really address these kinds of deficits that our culture is maybe encountering more and more, is my point. Okay. Yeah. So the values sport fosters. I think sport can foster fairness. I think it can foster community, cooperation, individual excellence. Okay, well, I'm going to take that back. Here we go. Because at this point, you're all probably sitting there thinking, okay, rah, rah, sports, look at this guy, you know, foaming at the mouth, hooray for sports. But I hope I'm not naive, because there is a but here. I think it's also clear that sport is uniquely good at fostering some things that we don't like violence, misogyny, alienation, and the desire for competition for its own sake. All right, this is where we see these kinds of, we could call them vices, also come up a lot in sports. And so an important question, I think, for a philosopher, for all of us, is, well, which of the two columns does sport produce more of? Do you understand my point here? And I am actually asking, I don't know if you have a feeling about this. If you can't, you know, you're a self-selecting group. If you came to a talk about sports and ethics, you know, you probably have some sympathies towards sports, but...
Left.
Well, I think...
The left.
I think thinking into... And maybe you made this distinction before I arrived late, I'm sorry, but the distinction between participatory sports and just spectator sports.
Mm.
And because I would say they definitely weigh differently for those two things. And they, so I'll leave it at that.
Okay, but I mean, is your point partly that you think that it's more important to actually participate in sports than just simply spectate, be a fan? Or,
well, a lot of the things that we say sport can foster fairness,
yeah,
community, all those things, well, fairness, you know, that's true. You know, you're envisioning the soccer, the kid growing up playing soccer and the coach doing this and,
yeah,
and this and that, but you watch any sport and there's, you know, fairness. I mean, it's really... that's subservient to your team winning. I mean, it really, and pretty much any,
okay,
Maradona, the hand of God, you know, I mean, any sport example you can name, you know, gymnastics, it's kind of hard to cheat.
Uh-huh.
You know, there might be some way that you can do that, but,
okay,
but for the most part, you know, there's a clear difference that I see between the way that, the role that sports, participatory sports, has in society versus spectator sport.
Okay. So part of what I heard, though, I heard you kind of make a point for, you know, talked about, when it comes down to it, it's all about winning. And, I mean, that's in the right-hand column, but, yeah. Yeah?
I was just given a book about college football and the University of Montana in Missoula. I think the title of the book, John Krakauer wrote it.
Uh-huh.
Missoula.
Okay.
I
haven't read it.
I've just started reading, but I gather that John Krakauer is not positive about the Missoula, the University of Montana football, at least those teams that the period that he covered.
Okay. That book's actually more about...
It's rape in Missoula, I think, is the subtitle.
It's more about what happened in the culture in the city and in the district attorney's office. It's more about... less about the university, which actually dealt with things fairly well, and more about how things were not done in our society the way they need to be done. So
more about the community around the football,
yeah,
team than the football team itself. Okay.
Yeah, but the prosecutor is one,
yeah,
of the ones that's more implicated than anything else. Not necessarily the team. Not that bad things didn't happen on the team, they did, and they happened in many university towns. Many teams, but it's about the whole picture, not just that university. It could have been any.
I read the introduction. I think you said this is just an example.
Yeah.
It's not a condemnation of Missoula. Maybe it is. I'm just talking about that.
Yeah, I've read it.
Missoula.
Yeah.
Missoula. Yeah.
And I would just say that, you know, it sounds like a little bit all these comments are coming on, touching on fandom, right? And so I'm going to talk about fandom later here, you know, because that obviously plays a big role in how we think about sports too. So let me just say, to kind of move it to the next slide here, but, you know, I heard one vote for the left-hand column. Whichever side you might fall on here, I think we have to recognize that to some extent, which of these two columns is more prevalent in our society might depend on the types of sports that are popular and that are practiced in our societies, right?
And I think for me,
yeah,
it depends on what the coaches are like.
Sure.
I mean, I used to ref, and some teams were amazing and,
yeah,
stood up to the left. And then you get the team who is on the right, and you're just like...
Right.
You know, so I think the coaching role also can make every sport fall into either one of these okay. on how the coach sees what sport and the purpose of it is for.
So, so it comes down a lot to the individual players who are in charge of these teams and athletes to say whether it's going to shift more to the left or the right. Mm-hmm. Okay, I think that's a great point. Just to share with you, though, it might be, and some philosophers argue this way, maybe we have the wrong sports, right? Maybe the sports we tend to idolize and practice and focus on, football and so forth, maybe they tend, I'm not saying they do, because I don't have an opinion about that particularly strongly, but maybe they tend to produce more of the bad values than the good ones. And so with that in mind, a little quiz here quickly. Here's some we'll call them alternative sports. They're not popular in the United States. I just want to see if you know what these are.
That's hugely popular.
Where?
North Dakota.
Oh.
We're having a camp just on dodgeball ball.
Right. I would just say, you're the first person who's ever recognized what that is.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, it hasn't come here yet.
What's the name again?
Gaga.
Here it is.
We can set it up this evening. I'd love to play a game.
Great. That would be fantastic.
No, you can use picnic tables.
Cool.
It's more fun with barbed wire. This is great. This is a game that originated in Israel and has kind of been, I think, spreading. The fascinating thing to me is, so I hadn't known about this until a couple of years ago, where I live in Anacortes, all of our elementary schools have Gaga pits. It's called a Gaga pit. So I don't know why that is, but I don't know why North Dakota has so many Gaga pits. It's fun. And here's the thing, right? This is what I like about this picture. Okay, you'll notice here a whole different variety of body types. You've got a tall boy there next to a little girl, a couple other girls, right? And so boys are not an advantage here over girls. Being bigger is not necessarily an advantage over being smaller, right? And so we have these sports that, yes, okay, basketball, right? If you're taller, you have an advantage just by virtue of being taller. But this is a different kind of sport here, right? Maybe there's
Is it always the same size?
No, you can do it just by
Anybody recognize that one? Look, it says hold it.
Hold it.
Wow, that's eerie. But anyway.
It was in the Olympics. They had this in the Olympics.
Bing, bing, right? Netball. Right. Hold in there. That's it. So this is practiced in Southeast Asia, Australia, New Zealand. Hold in is a car brand in Australia, maybe New Zealand as well. So this is called netball. Obviously, it looks like basketball. But you, of course, all this stuff, you can go on YouTube and find videos of people doing this. Of course, these are all women here in this picture. It is, from my understanding, maybe you know more, but more practiced by women, not exclusively, but more so. And the videos I've seen, it's a much less physical version of basketball to some extent. And again, maybe this might be more, get more women involved in these kinds of sports, right? Not that there aren't women who play basketball very well, but that's another example. Anybody recognize this one? I didn't think so. I was kind of hoping Alan would be here today. This is called 360 ball. It's, I think, a proprietary kind of deal. And it's from South Africa, I think invented in South Africa. And it's kind of like racquetball, but you kind of hit it in this dish and back and forth. And again, the thing I like about this, because as I said on the previous slide, I think one of the negative things that sports often produce is misogyny, right? Men being superior to women. Well, you can see here once again, you've got women and men actually there. It's hard to see. But you've got women and men competing together. And again, I think this is a very valuable thing. And maybe we need to think about other sports to create better outcomes in terms of the values they produce. Just throw that at you. But let's talk about competition, because competition is obviously a big part of sports, and is it valuable or not? Well, here's some thoughts on competition, right? Winning isn't everything, it's the only thing, from Brad Sanders.
I thought that was outdated.
It's kind of apocryphal who said it, you know, but
I
tried to.
Vince Lombardi, yeah, it's Vince Lombardi.
I try to look up, get to the real source there. At any rate, this is a British philosopher, Simon Critchley, who says that sport is obviously the continuation of war by other means. So apparently, sport or competitive sport is a very negative thing. But the philosopher Nicholas Dixon says that realizing that winning is not the be-all and end-all of athletic excellence may help to foster the cooperation that is part of healthy competition and prevent it from degenerating into alienation, right? To something that's going to harm, I guess, human flourishing, we might say. And so I might bring up this quote just to say that there are at least some philosophers who say that competition isn't universally bad, and maybe it's a good thing. So let's think about competition here. You know, we wouldn't do that in the grocery store, right? That's the last cantaloupe. We wouldn't, you know, that's not how we'd get the last cantaloupe. And so we might think, if that's not something we do in a grocery store, it might feel wrong to do it on a field. You might react to that in a negative way and think, there's something not right about that. But as I said earlier, to get back to your question, there are sports that don't inherently feature competition, depending on how you define sports. I would define dance as a sport, okay? And there are competitions in dance, but they don't have to be. Hacky sack, a Holden favorite, at least used to be when I was a volunteer here. It's not so popular these days, which makes me sad. But hacky sack is, again, I think it's actually a cooperative sport. You work together to try and keep the foot bag up in the air as long as possible. Parkour is another one, where you're running around in usually an urban environment and doing sort of tricks and jumping off. It sounds very dangerous, but at any rate, it's not necessarily competitive either, and we can think of others. So I think an important question is whether or not there's something inherently valuable about putting yourself through competition. And so to think about that, we need to understand, well, what is the nature of competition? The philosopher Robert Simon, he cites several people who suggest that competition amounts to being selfish, right? What is competition about? It's about getting that trophy at the end. You want it for yourself or for your team or for your community. And so the nature of competition on this view is that it's about being selfish. It's about getting something for yourself. Simon rejects that view. He argues against that and instead defines competition as a mutually acceptable quest for excellence through challenge. In other words, by challenging one another, you know that you're going to get better at whatever it is you're attempting to do. And so, again, here Simon has a very much more of a positive outlook on competition. Interestingly, why do I have a picture of this Chinese badminton player here? Maybe you've heard about this. I can give you a couple of references if you want to find out more about this. But in 2012, some Olympic badminton players from China and also Indonesia, as it turns out, they intentionally played below their abilities and were subsequently disqualified. I don't know if you heard about this, but the way the Olympic badminton tournament was sort of set up, the Chinese team and, again, the Indonesian team, they realized that if they lost to a particular team, they would still continue to play, and then they would have a better seeding in the next match and be more likely to win at that level, if that kind of makes sense. And so I've heard stories about how poorly they played. It was just sort of, you know, I could have kept up with them, right? Is that bad? So they played really poorly, and in fact, it was so obvious to everybody in the audience, they were booing them, and then in fact, they were disqualified for that. My point here is that, in fact, had they been competing, like legitimately competing, trying to defeat the other team, that would have been unselfish, right? That would have been the unselfish act if they really were trying to defeat the other team there. So I think it's a counterpoint to the idea that competition is always selfish. Their refusing to compete was actually the selfish act in this case. But competition isn't always a good thing, because sometimes competition breeds the desire for performance enhancement in illegitimate ways, such as pursuing performance-enhancing drugs, right? Lance Armstrong, enough said, right? It's moving on, right? Genetic engineering is going to be coming into this soon, if not already, where you'll be able to, even in your own genome, affect it in such a way that you'll be able to improve your athletic performance, or perhaps in your children's athletic performance. Or, why do I have a picture of, he looks like Bane, right, from Batman. But anyway, this is called an oxygen deprivation mask, right? That's not, I guess, illegitimate. You can find these things online. And basically, so you understand what this does, it apparently recreates the...
high altitude.
Yeah, thank you. It recreates training at high altitude, right? If you train, like at Holden Village or Flagstaff, Arizona is a popular place, your ability to use oxygen training at a high altitude is improved, and then you're able to better compete or have more stamina at lower altitudes. And this training mask kind of recreates that environment, if that makes sense. So, what about this stuff? Well, of course, a lot of people are thinking, right, especially those of us who might condemn Lance Armstrong and the like, they think that, you know, using performance-enhancing drugs and genetic engineering and strange training regimens is somehow illegitimate, inappropriate. But the philosopher John Hoberman notes that there's no clear distinction between, say, natural and artificial. That there's no bright line there between what's natural and what's artificial, right? So, somebody who takes some kind of anabolic steroid, right, injects that into their arm in order to achieve better athletic performance. That seems very artificial, right? On the other hand, you know, we go to the store and we see these giant tubs of protein powder or things that are supposed to be edible but are not food. I don't know how you
I don't know how you describe that. Is that really natural then, right? Whereas anabolic steroids is artificial, but eating large quantities of this stuff that comes in these big tubs is somehow natural? That's not always clear. Is it natural to move to Flagstaff or Holden Village and train at a high altitude to improve your ability to process oxygen, whereas to wear this mask is artificial? You know, is there really a clear line between the two? Is there a clear line between, Hoberman asks, between rehabilitation and performance enhancement? So perhaps the best soccer player in the world, Lionel Messi, right, Argentinian soccer player, when he was a child, his parents gave him human growth hormone, which enabled him to grow bigger than he would have otherwise done. Was that simply to rehabilitate what have been, he would have ended up being a person of short stature, perhaps? Is that
He's
a
not tall, though.
He's not. So imagine how much less tall he would have been without the human growth hormone.
Yeah, I think in that case, though, it might be because there is a need for human growth hormone for kids who are not going to get to a normal stature. Maybe, I keep your point there.
Yeah, so, yeah, my point is simply, Hoberman's point, is simply that there's no bright line, right? At what point is somebody, this person can legitimately take human growth hormone to achieve a certain height, but that person cannot, where, you know, another person takes it, it's just about performance enhancement versus just rehabilitating being of short stature. Yeah?
I just want to throw this in here because it's not talked about a lot. I took human growth hormone. I had growth hormone deficiency and would have stayed a lot shorter than I am today.
Yeah.
I don't know. That's all.
Okay, thanks. Right.
Stand up. That's all.
Yeah, yeah.
6 feet. I don't know.
Nice.
That's just not
I good. Didn't, and I'm not 6 feet.
Right. You also hear stories of jockeys when they were young, break growth plates so they could be a jockey.
They did what now?
They would break growth plates
so
that they'd stop growing so they could be a jockey and be competitive. I mean, so it goes both ways. Sometimes you want height, and sometimes you don't. If you're a gymnast,
you're
getting too tall.
Right. And we worry, right? Many people worry. Well, some behaviors seem illegitimate. Oh, that's cheating or, you know, trying to achieve some advantage that you shouldn't legitimately have. But it's not clear, right? I mean, 6 feet, well, that's awfully tall to somebody like me. But, you know, to somebody else, it's like being a short person. Yeah.
What about genetic engineering in the future?
Absolutely.
Engineer athletes.
Absolutely. So this is where we're going to come into this, and it all relates together, right? This all ties together. But what's the difference between, Hoberman says, there's really no bright line between restoration, healing, and boosting, that is improving, right? One thing I like to tell people is that, all of us here in the 21st century, we are the products of, you know, sort of enhancement, right? If we were to go back 500 years and look at the human beings who lived then, they would have been these very, you know, short, not very long-lived people, compared to us, because we have superior nutrition and so forth. We might all feel like, well, sure, we eat this wonderful food in the Holden kitchen here. That's just about, you know, keeping us healthy. But other people might see that as, no, you're just, you know, boosting beyond what is natural or something like that. And again, there's no bright line or clear line between the two, is his point. Okay? To kind of continue this thought, right? John Hoberman asks, what makes sport the one type of performance that can be corrupted by pharmacological intervention, right? People are very upset about Lance Armstrong and others who take these drugs and other things to achieve some athletic advantage. Why is sport the one type of performance that can be corrupted by this kind of intervention, right? This is where it's confession time for me. So I have to tell you that this presentation, I am on coffee right now. I had coffee this morning, right? So just have to admit that. But nobody feels dirty now, right? We don't feel like, nobody's getting out and leaving at this point because it's obviously illegitimate that I had coffee and now I'm talking to you about this stuff. Hoberman talks about symphony performers who before a performance will take beta blockers so they're better able to perform, right? And if we go to a performance of a symphony, we find out that, you know, some of the people in the orchestra had taken beta blockers to produce better music. We don't get upset. We don't think, oh, I want to hear natural music. Yes?
Is it because there's not a competition there? I don't know. I'm just asking.
Yeah. I think that's a great question. At the same time, right, even though there's not an official competition between the Seattle Symphony and whatever else, they want to be known as the best.
Right.
They want
there's
to be
competition to get in.
There's competition to
right.
get in.
So, yeah.
They want to have a reputation they want to establish.
Right. I know.
Yeah.
It really comes down to the one of the bullet points earlier, the idea of fairness. And it's certainly the case of does everybody sort of have the same playing field? And of course, everybody knows it's not true because certain people are biologically bigger than others or more gifted, Michael Jordan. Mm-hmm. But there's still that idea that there should be that sort of fairness. And so if Lance Armstrong takes this and nobody else does, which of course isn't true either, but if that's the case, then everybody gets really upset. And then and baseball players that have been sort of convicted of taking performance enhancing drugs, it really wrecks their reputation. They don't get into the Hall of Fame. I mean, there's all kinds of things like that's sort of a negative thing where, we have sort of drawn this imaginary funny line that says this is fair and that's not.
Right. So just to share, Hoberman's point is that he thinks that our prohibitions, these rules that prohibit people who are cyclists and so forth from taking steroids, from doing blood doping and these other practices, he thinks these should be dropped. He thinks that, we should have the Olympics, right? If you want to take steroids, if you want to, risk perhaps some health consequences, that's you're an adult, you should have that right to do that. He thinks we should not be so puritanical, I guess we might say, with regard to these prohibitions on drugs and these other interventions. Personally, I don't agree, and neither does a philosopher by Michael Sandel, who kind of thinks about this issue. And he argues that if we came to think of ourselves as wholly self-made men and women through chemical, and then we could go on and say biological engineering, this would have some very bad ramifications for society, humans in general. First of all, we would lose our humility, right? We would say, look, I want to be the best at this or that or the other thing. I'll take the drug, I'll do the genetic engineering, and we wouldn't have to be humble. We could just go out there and get what we wanted to have. We would become responsible for everything about ourselves. Or to think about this in terms of a parent to a child, right? If it were possible to genetically engineer the superior athlete and you're going to have a child, right? You think, oh, gee, what if I don't get the genetic engineering that will give them, this particular height or the particular webbed fingers? I said I was a swimmer, right? Webbed fingers would be great. The choice to have a child then would be much more fraught, right? Because I have to make all these decisions. Gosh, I think, they should have these qualities. And if I don't choose to have the engineering or give them the drugs to enable them to have that, maybe I'm a bad parent. I think most importantly for Sandel and myself, because I agree with you here, there would be less of a basis for solidarity. There would be the enhanced people, and there would be the rest of us. And this is going to have negative consequences for humanity as a whole. To wit, I guess we could say. Enhancement would become yet another arena to develop the gap between the wealthy and the rest of us, right? We talk about economic inequality and the widening gap between the rich and the rest of us. Your physical abilities then would be another arena where you would see this gap. You would have the people who've got the genetic engineering, taken the right drugs and so forth, and you have the rest of us who can't afford that. And by the rest of us, that might not mean the United States, right? Maybe this stuff could be made affordable here, or maybe we make enough money to pursue that. But think about the difference between the United States and the rest of the world, right? Where people can't afford these kinds of treatments. And so I think he makes a very good point here. And then finally, I just share this picture here. Of course, this is Paul Allen, the owner of the Portland Trailblazers. And this is from a couple of years ago. He was at the basketball playoffs. And his team had been ahead. The Trailblazers had been ahead against the Golden State Warriors at one point. And the Golden State Warriors came back and made this, terrific comeback, okay? And the look on his face, to me, is priceless, okay? He's one of the richest people in the world, right? One of the richest people who's ever been. And his involvement in sports, right, means that he is able to be, you can see it right there on his face, he's able to be humbled, right? He doesn't control the outcome. He wants his team to succeed. He's willing to invest money in it, but he does not control the outcome. And that's a good thing for Paul Allen. Right? For even the most wealthy person that maybe has ever lived to feel a sense of humility and that not everything is in his control. So just kind of leave that at that. Fandom. So there are sports fans out there. Interesting point here. 50 years ago, just 3 in 10 Americans considered themselves sports fans. By 2012, that proportion exceeded 6 in 10. This quote is from an article in the Washington Post. I want to share the title with you. I think you'll find it particularly interesting. The title of this article was, "Is Religion Losing Ground to Sports?" And they suggest in the article that because more and more people are less and less interested in religion, what do they do with their Sundays, right, instead of going to church? They watch, you know, the NFL, whatever. They watch sports on TV, right? That's their kind of argument, I guess we'd say. It's fairly implicit in this article. I honestly, I don't quite buy that. That is that, you know, it's because people are less interested in religion that they're going to devote themselves to sports. There might be something to that. A person in an earlier presentation pointed out that, well, what's the difference between 50 years ago and 2012? Well, one big difference, right, of course, is the media, right? And in, what would that be, 1962, right? If you want to watch a baseball game, you could do that on TV. But it's going to be, you know, very blurry picture and black and white and so forth. And it's, you know, somewhat engaging. But today, right, you watch a baseball game on TV and you've got the main picture and you've got the, you know, the picture in the picture and you've got all this data. It's a much more engaging experience, right? You've got super slow-mo and the like. And so, honestly, I think they've misread the situation. I think probably the reason so many more people are interested in sports than they used to be, at least as spectators, is due to the media being able to present it in such a more appealing manner.
I think it's part of it, but I would argue that just as big a part is every sport has gotten very good at marketing and tie-in marketing. Mm-hmm. Lots of and basically, you know, feed the whole, you know, make the consumer part of it. You know, you get the hats, you get the
talking about the 12th man here, maybe.
Yeah, it's
yeah. They're very good at that, right? And not maybe 50 years ago, that wasn't as much the case. At tying fans in, bringing them in. So we need to think about fandom. How, you know, is this a good thing to be doing? Is it important? Does it produce any good outcomes? Of course, why are we fans? Well, I think we're attracted to the admirable. We want to see human excellence on display. I think we need to recognize that fandom can bring people together, right? Again, yes, fewer people are attending the religious, you know, the church, the mosque, the synagogue, than used to be the case. And so people still need to come together, though, even if they're not religious, and going to a sporting event can bring people together, and that's a good thing, I think. I searched the internet, I was trying to find a picture where, you know, and you might have seen this yourself somewhere, but you go to, say, a Seahawks game or some sporting event, and you will find, right, even though the majority of the people there are fans of the home team, you'll find those people who came from afar to watch the visiting team. And it's a very valuable lesson, I think, that those of you who might be fans of the home team can respect those who have shown up in the opposing team's jersey, right? And you can then hopefully know how to respond to people with whom we disagree. You think their players are bums? That's fine. But we can still, you know, sit next to each other and enjoy the spectacle before us.
It's easier to accept them when they're not beating you.
It's easier to accept them when they're not beating you, absolutely, right? But, you know, I think in the United States, at least, we have... This tends to be a positive experience, right? I share that because a number of years ago, I traveled to Argentina, and I went to a soccer game of the Boca Juniors, one of the most popular teams in Argentina in Buenos Aires. And there, you don't mix, okay? You have the fans of the Boca Juniors sit in one side of the stadium, and the visiting team fans, they have their own section. But that's not it. That's not all of it. When the game ended, the home team fans, you didn't leave. You sat down for half an hour while the other visiting fans left under police guard, actually military guard. So doesn't work out that way so much in other places in the world. But I think in many places in the United States, we do respect one another. And that's a good place to learn how to do that, I think. And of course, as we heard in the opening story today, attending a sporting event can give us the opportunity to witness morally admirable behavior, right, in the flesh, right there. Mallory Holtman and the shortstop carrying this person around the bases so she could score the home run that would end up defeating the Wildcats of Central Washington University. So if we're talking about ethics, and philosophers usually are, we want to ask us if there's a right way to be a fan. So a Swedish philosopher by the name of Torbjörn Tännsjö, if I can pronounce it correctly, too many umlauts in there for me, but anyway, he argues that admiration for sports heroes is fascistoid because it involves contempt for the loser, meaning if you're a sports fan, you have tendencies toward fascism, he says. Because if you admire a sports hero, what that amounts to is tantamount to having contempt for the person who loses them, you have contempt for them. You pity them, you think they're horrible. this view of things, I don't think rings very true to myself or most people. And I don't think it rings true in general. In the Olympics, he actually talks about the Olympics in the article where he shares this idea. In the Olympics, you have your gold, you have your silver, you have your bronze, right? People are excited to get a silver or a bronze medal. I mean, yeah, they didn't win the gold medal, but almost always, right, they're thrilled to get any kind of medal. And when they return to their home countries, right, they're celebrated, even if they didn't get a gold medal. So I think that example by itself tends to suggest this is probably inaccurate. The philosopher Nicholas Dixon has a very different view. He argues for moderate, what he calls moderate partisan fandom. Now, what is that? Well, let me contrast it, as he does, with something called a purist. Dixon defines a purist fan as somebody who is not a fan of any particular player or any particular team. A purist fan is only a fan of a beautiful play itself. A beautiful marathon run or a beautiful catch, you know, if we're talking about baseball or something like this. Purist fans are not fans of particular players or teams. They're just fans of the beautiful event or activity in sports. Dixon does not think that's the best way to be a fan. Dixon argues that we ought to be partisans. That is, we ought to develop loyalty to particular sports players or sporting teams because by being partisan, it helps us to develop loyalty, and that's a valuable thing. But he uses the word moderate because that loyalty cannot be absolute, right? So you can be a fan of the Seahawks, you can be a fan of this, that, or the other thing, but if they turn into the Oakland Raiders, right, you just can't be a fan. No, I would, anyway, that's just a jab at the Oakland Raiders. But if there's a team, right, let's say, that turns into a bunch of hooligans who are violating the law and doing horrible things, there should be a limit to your fandom then, right? You should break your loyalty then if the team or the athletes, right, Lance Armstrong, maybe you're a fan of Lance Armstrong, and then you realize he cheated and violated all these rules, your loyalty should end at that point, according to Dixon. So a couple ways to think about fandom there. Finally, in this topic of fandom, and then I can move to esports, fantasy sports, right? This topic might be of more interest to those of you who do not live in Washington State because fantasy sports are illegal in Washington State. So here are a couple of major corporations behind fantasy sports. So fantasy sports are where right, you go and you choose a team, whatever sport you might be dealing with, and then these websites, you can go and basically try and win money by choosing players in a certain way. The question is, and the reason it's illegal in Washington State is because, at least according to, I guess, people involved in making it illegal, they see that fantasy sports are actually more of a game of chance, more like gambling, than a game of skill. Okay. And in fact, if you look at the people who do participate in fantasy sports around the country, other than here, the ones who succeed bring to bear vast computer resources. And they look at statistics and so forth, how all these players perform and so forth. And I don't know all the details here, obviously, but somehow these computer programs spit out, you know, here, play these players, and it makes it very likely for them to win money. They're using big data in those cases, right? And I like to point out that big data, I feel like, is an attempt to control the world. And I just like to make this reference here because I was kind of into big data. I was into people using statistics in very sophisticated ways to think about the future and to be able to predict what's going to happen to make my life, to make myself feel better, right? That I was just really kind of riding the crest of this and thinking, yes, I can look at the statistics. This outcome is very likely. I felt very good. And then I woke up, what was it, November 7th, and I didn't feel good anymore. And big data had let me down, right? Because this isn't literally true, but you know, we could imagine there were people out there who went to sleep at one point on the night of the election, and one candidate had an 85% chance of winning, and then they, oh good, turn off the TV, big data tells me this is the way the world's going to be, wake up the next morning, and no, it's flipped completely. So I think that these attempts to control the world, looking at probabilities, really are not ultimately, I think, worth it. And I would say that fantasy sports, another sort of concern I have about fantasy sports is that I have heard stories about how fantasy sports can turn people into objects. So I've heard stories. Somebody is going to play a particular fantasy team, and they select certain players, and then they watch and see how they did that day, how they performed, to see if they're going to win money or, you know, beat out their friends in their fantasy league. And I've heard stories where a player they chose gets injured, right, that day, And so their fantasy team just, you know, falls apart, and they don't win any money, and they lose to their friends or whatever the case may be. And I've heard stories that when that player gets injured, the people who had picked them for their fantasy team, they'll like email them or tweet at them, I guess, and say, "Oh, you bum," maybe stronger language than that. You know, "Why did you get hurt? You know, you really screwed up my fantasy team," right? Now that's, to me, a perfectly good example of morally illegitimate behavior. It's turning that person, you don't care about the person that got hurt. You know, this person broke their leg, it was excruciatingly painful. That doesn't matter to you. They were a cog in your fantasy team, and they let you down, and so you're upset. And that seems to be...
Well, but that doesn't start in fantasy sports. I mean, even something a little bit more benign, like we had a Sounders game, and the player, probably from Portland, gets laid out. And eventually, maybe bring out a stretcher, and the fans start shouting, "Let him die, let him die." I mean, it's, you know, that stuff happens in football.
Yeah.
I mean, it's, I think you're always, you know, the bigger problem is really, is not so much, I think at that level, it's more on a higher plane of you, say, why is this such a big deal? I mean, that's the thing to ask, and it gets back to the idea of what are the values that this is instilling, and I would argue that it's basically tribalism, and you're just, there's just different ways of sort of, of either making money off of that, or keeping it going, because that's, you know, why else would Portland and Seattle hate each other? I mean, it's, you got to come up with something, and come up, you know, we don't fight each other, you know, like Greek city-states or anything like that for territory, it's, so it's, you know, there's a lot of things going on, and it's sort of hard to figure, you know, point, say, oh, this is where the problems are, this is where, you know, it's this huge collection of different human issues which come to play in sports that, that, you know, sometimes are tolerable, and sometimes you just shake your head and go, really?
Well, yeah, so there's this tension between, like, Dixon praises fandom for promoting loyalty, right, or loyalty to a team or a player, but there's that tension with tribalism, right, and loyalty to a point where it makes no sense, hating people from Portland simply because, you know, they have a different soccer team. My point here simply is that I think fantasy sports, more than other avenues of interacting with sports or being a spectator or a fan, tends to, you know, see these players as more of a cog in your fantasy team rather than as a human being, you know, living their life and trying to do good things. Of course, that's horrible when you say, you know, let him die. I mean, that's clearly immoral behavior.
Yeah, I mean, it's a little bit tongue in cheek if you're doing that, but there is that element of, you know, your loyalty. You know, who are you loyal to? Some people who follow a player, that's great no matter where he goes. Or you'd still be a fan of him. But anyway, Alex Rodriguez left Seattle, and he was instantly, that's it, you know.
Right.
A-Rod's gone, he chased the money, and he was, you know, he couldn't get, nobody was buying a drink here after that, probably, so in Seattle.
Right. Okay, yeah, thank you. Let me get to the last topic, then, for my presentation, esports. If they are sports. So here's a nice quote, and I apologize for not getting the name of the wife, but I got this from an article, and the wife's name was never mentioned. But anyway, the wife of Robert Morris University Associate Athletic Director Kurt Melcher said, "Why should a college scholarship only be given to some kid who can put a ball into a hole?" Right? And so she is making the point that maybe people who can perform well in video games should be given scholarships as well. To kind of go along with that, the philosopher Jane English argues that we should develop a variety of sports in which a variety of physical types can expect to excel. And so, you know, if the only sports you have on offer are football, basketball, maybe baseball, those are only going to fit certain body types, you know, very well and leave a whole bunch of people out. And Jane English sees that as very problematic. So maybe esports is another avenue for this. But of course, we have to ask, are esports truly sports? So given Suits' definition, so that's the one I tend to have sympathies for, are esports truly sports? And again, Suits' definition was one where you had to involve physical skill, and what you're doing has to be admirable, and be stable, and have a wide following. Those are the components, just to remind you. And actually, I would say that, okay, look, I'm not making a joke here, but clearly people who participate in esports are not, by virtue of participating in esports, athletes. They might be athletes for other reasons. But they're not athletes. But then again, the same might be said of curlers or NASCAR drivers, that they're not particularly athletic, let's say. I don't know. I think in the last time I gave this presentation, I stepped on some curlers' toes. They were a little bit upset. But anyway, if you know what curling is with the thing, you push it. I mean, some of you probably in Minnesota, North Dakota, they do it probably too. Yeah. So anyway, you know, maybe they are somewhat athletic, but it's not necessarily the most athletic of all sports. NASCAR drivers, again, I'm not saying there's not a great deal of skill there, but they might not be athletes. And I don't know. I was thinking about this today. I went down to the pool hall playing billiards. Given Suits' definition, billiards is a sport, right? It involves physical skill. You can't play billiards with just your voice. You have to get down there with your hands and move things around. But somebody can play billiards and not be an athlete, you know, whatsoever. So there are, it seems, sports that are not involving athletics. Maybe esports then is one of these. I think this is an important question, right? Because sports are supported in cultures in a much more significant way than mere games in our culture and I think other cultures. And I would say that, I think I need to hold off on this because I'll get to it in a different slide. The question is, how far should this support go? By the way, I didn't mention, this is an esports event in South Korea. And you can see the whole arena is filled there. And it's obviously generating a lot of spectators.
The Democrats and Republicans.
Yeah, I don't know. Doesn't mean that in South Korea, I think. But anyway. Okay. So let's talk a little bit about game playing versus playing sports, and I'll get back to my idea about esports. Oh, I'm going to get back to it now. Sorry. I think esports are on their way to being bona fide sports, okay? You cannot play, let's put it this way, you have to have some amount, in fact, a great amount of physical skill to be able to play certain video games that are actually part of the esports teams or leagues that are going on. You have to be able to move your fingers in very fast ways, in very particular ways, and so forth. And so there is a physical skill. As we just saw in the last picture, it has a wide following. It's on ESPN now. There are actual leagues involved now and organizations, institutions that have arisen to support esports. So I do think that esports are on the way to being bona fide sports. I think at the same time, we can also ask whether all sports should be valued equally. And I think that's a legitimate question. So for example, because another element of Suits' definition is that what they're doing is admirable. Well, is miniature golf as admirable a pursuit as gymnastics? I mean, I like miniature golf. I'm not trying to denigrate miniature golf. Let me be clear about this. But somebody who, you know, is doing miniature golf, that's wonderful. It's fun and so forth. But it's not necessarily as admirable as gymnastics, a very challenging activity.
Okay, so admirable,
let me get to the next slide.
Okay.
Yeah, because I think I know what you're thinking about.
Okay.
Yeah. Why would we rank one sport over another? Okay, let me get to that here. Okay, are some sports better than others?
Okay.
I want to make sure you read the heading here. Rhythmic gymnastics versus MMA. I'm not saying rhythmic gymnasts versus MMA. That would be a terrible idea. Rhythmic gymnastics versus mixed martial arts. Some sports are no doubt more popular than others. Mixed martial arts is way more popular than rhythmic gymnastics. But are they therefore better just by virtue of being more popular? Suits argue that a sport must involve doing something admirable, right? This is we're getting back to. If a sport carries a high risk of brain damage, is it admirable, right? I don't know if that was what you're kind of thinking about, but mixed martial arts, there's a higher degree of probability of brain damage. We know about the same thing happening in football and other sports as well. I think that affects its admirability. Okay. So, if there are activities which are more or less admirable, there could be more or less admirable sports. That's my point here. So, to bring this back to esports then, where would they rank? I think it's very important to understand that not everyone can physically participate in the same sports. There was a story I saw on somewhere, a television story, about a person who, I don't know what sport he used to participate in some sort of athletic sport, and then he had some sort of disease, and so he couldn't participate in that sport anymore. And what he did is he took up drone racing, okay? And so, yeah, his body would not allow him to participate in whatever sport he used to participate in, but then he was doing drone racing, and you have to be able to physically move the controllers around and race your drone around. And so that, I think, is a sport. For those who can't participate in more physically engaging sports, I think esports are a worthwhile pursuit. But for those who are not limited in those ways, I would strongly encourage participation in more athletic sports. Why? Well, esports, I think, and we talked about this earlier, but they don't produce virtues such as courage, integrity, and community as much as other sports. Now, I've had people who can call this correct me, if you like, about especially the community aspect. Again, I'm not a gamer, so I'm a little bit out of my depth here, but people told me, look, actually in esports, people will come over and get together and, I guess, hook their computers up and have some kind of competition or whatever. And so there is community being formed there. I would agree. But in esports, right, you're not going to really face legitimate danger like you might in other sporting activities. People have corrected me about the integrity issue as well. I imagine that if you're doing esports, there's really very little way you can cheat because it's like governed by the computer, you know. But then other people were telling me, no, there are some ways to cheat, though it does sound like it's fairly limited. I mean, it's not like doctoring a baseball or taking performance-enhancing drugs or such. So anyway, my point here is I think esports can be valuable sports, but since they don't necessarily produce these kinds of outcomes as much as other sports do, I personally would rank them a little lower in the pecking order there. At any rate, I want to end with this thought, and that is my message here is that I think sports are valuable to participate in, not as valuable to be spectators of. If we find ourselves able to participate in sports, if we don't find ourselves able to participate in sports, we rob ourselves of a central part of being human. I think, can tend to neglect thinking about our bodies, and I think that's an important part of who we are. So, if you wanted to download a free bibliography listing books, films, and websites on ethics and sports, you go to that website. You can follow me on Twitter. You can email me there. And if you want to go to Humanities Washington and find out about their other speakers bureau people, you can go there. I say all that, I say thank you, but if there are questions or comments at this point, yeah.
What's your take on sports and money? I guess specifically with child sports and select leagues that.
I'm interjecting something in there. Fairness, I think is.
Like that you have to pay money to have your child participate, or?
So you could do like a rec sport, right?
Yeah.
If you wanted play, at a legal level, you have to pay money.
Right.
And if you don't have that money, then
right.
Then you might not be participating, right?
Right.
So what's your whole take on that whole?
Yeah.
Select sports is huge now in the age space, in the kids.
I think you and I may be talking about the same thing. I'll give you an example. In Oregon and Washington, we have certain mega schools in sports. Usually it's the Catholic schools, not necessarily.
Mexico too.
What's that?
I think it's every state, Mexico too.
Yeah. And to me, it's an issue of fairness, and then it also is an issue of safety. There was a team up in Washington where it was so good that
nobody would play.
Forfeiting.
Yeah, I remember reading about that.
Team forfeiting. And with a colleague who was a football coach, I used to be a gymnast, but we talked this stuff all the time. And
yeah.
our team would never do well. We had one superstar. And then they did really well, but it's an anomaly. Yeah. And there were lots of injuries. I watched one high school team just absolutely clobber another team. Mm-hmm. And it was, you were worried that it was safe in the end.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking in terms of fairness that if you, and you talk about justice, and some of the things we've been talking about this week here, we've reached a point, and maybe even in pro sports, where you, in terms of fairness, you have to create a separate league. And in my mind, it's based upon socioeconomic status. Because
right.
If you look at Lake Oswego or certain other high schools in your area,
right
here in Washington, Lake Oswego in our area and other schools, it's how much money your family has to be able to send you to the camps in the summer.
Yeah.
And do all the things, drive kids around, do all those things. And it's rare. So I'm advocating for, if you want a super league, fine, but you're kicked out of this league for being too good on too consistent a basis because you have too much affluence. And the other league that should be created is one, we shouldn't have these leagues by size and the amount of kids in the school. That doesn't always do it. It's more what's your socioeconomic level. And if you looked at it that way, I bet you would find... But the same thing with pro sports. I mean, I don't think you're going to find an NBA team from certain places that's going to win the way things are going anymore. The Timberwolves or,
Yeah, I mean, I'm just saying that, just real quick to inject. I think it was clear from this that I think sports have a lot of good things that they bring to society and that all people need to participate. And so overall, my principle would be
how can society organize resources in such a way to enable as many people as possible to participate in sports, boys and girls, men and women, of all ages, in a safe environment, right? And that should be the goal. But because the goal is too often, as you said earlier, right, win, 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 it's all about, you know, achieving the trophy, there's too much competition, I think that's detrimental to all of us. So that, just to quickly respond to all that.
How many of you, I don't know if how many from Seattle, know the story of Nathan Hale High School basketball?
Yeah.
Nathan Hale is a high school in North Seattle. They were perpetually at the bottom of the league. They hired as a basketball coach Brandon Roy, who was an NBA player. He sort of had a friend, somehow roundabout way, got his friend who had two high school kids, very tall, incredible players, lived in Missouri. Brandon Roy arranged a particular way to have the father of those two boys hired as the assistant basketball coach at the University of Washington, which means that they moved to Seattle, they located in that high school district. These two kids went to that high school. Nathan Hale became the top basketball program in the country, number one, overnight. And it was just unbelievable. I mean, these kids were phenomenal. They were just, very tall, but were just lording over everybody. And so what's happened since then is Lorenzo Romar was fired as the University of Washington basketball coach. So his assistants also went with him. So this coach is no longer there. And so now the senior of the two really good basketball players was going to go to the University of Washington, but he's not going there anymore. Brandon Roy has now left that school as well. He's not going to coach there anymore. He's going to go coach at another high school in Seattle. So I think my point is, what message has been sent through this whole thing about what sports should mean at the high school level? And we see this stuff in pro sports all the time, that you know, teams move here to there, or players get bought, you know, traded away. I mean, there's lots of stuff that happened, but it's becoming so big at the high school level.
Yeah.
It's just incredible what the message that's sending for what sports
should
be.
You have kids that go through you see it all the time in our area, and I'm sure it's here too. They go through a developmental process in a certain district or area, and their team isn't going to be that good, and that kid jumps to a mega team, you know. So all these years have been spent with lots of labor on the part of parents and coaches to make a low income, usually struggling type of team good. Then you get this good player, and they get a better deal somewhere, you know. And that can be good in some ways, but in many ways it's become atrocious. You know, kids moving just to get a new team, and it denigrates, I think.
You know, there's some very inspirational stories in sports. And one film, I don't know if you've seen it, it's about this high school in California that was Hispanic area, and a guy went there to coach. I think it was
Richmond. Not Richmond High, right?
It's it starts with an R, but it's a really good movie that wasn't, I don't think it really did that well, but it's an incredible story of a case where a school that didn't have a lot of money, and it's just a very positive story about the whole thing, and it still is about that program there.
But I think it's Richmond High School.
Yeah. Okay. Maybe. I don't know. It's track and field or cross country. But in any case, but what's going on now in pretty much every part of the country is just, over the top.
Yeah.
Totally different question, but earlier when the question was raised about why is it with sports is the only time that performance-enhancing drugs is an issue,
Doesn't
part of it come down to two things, safety and a love of statistics? Right? Because like if you have a middle linebacker who's totally roided out of his mind and he comes through
right.
and kills somebody.
Right.
And then like in baseball you have guys like Barry Bonds, Roger Clemens, Mark McGwire, guys who were arguably the best in their field,
right,
will never make it into the Hall of Fame because
right,
they cheated.
Yeah, so two things. I mean, the response that I think is that, look, these are adults, and if they want to take those risks, this is Hoberman's point, if they want to, because people box, right, and they do mixed martial arts, and those are extremely dangerous, but they're adults, so we say, if you are willing to understand the risk and take that on, you know, you, Hoberman would argue you should be able to do that. But, oh, go ahead.
But then,
yeah,
but if you and I are boxing,
right,
and we are in agreement, we're going to fight, right, and then I take steroids,
right,
you didn't agree to that.
Right. And Hoberman says it should be a level playing field, right?
Oh.
Yeah, that's his point.
Give them to anybody who wants to.
Yeah, if everybody agrees.
And then if you enter into the ring or the field, you're
right,
under the understanding that the guy across from you is...
Yeah, I mean, so he's open to that possibility. I think it's an interesting question, though, because, like I said, why do we allow symphony performers to take these drugs to produce better music? I think it's because we see beautiful music... Or writing a good book, right? If somebody's taking a lot of caffeine, right, to be able to think faster way or something like this. We see those as beneficial for all of society, whereas sports, right, if you take steroids, it's for your own personal glory and not a societal benefit.
And I kind of think, you know, struggling artists, financially, physically, emotional, it has been Beethoven, Mozart, like, eons.
Mm-hmm.
That has been okay because it shows that you went through and, like, through that pain and sorrow and suffering, you saw it, and all this darkness, this beautiful work. You don't see that. That's not how you see sports, though.
Mm-hmm.
It's this majestic feat versus struggling artists. I think just the words associated with a writer versus a boxer are going to be completely different. And I think that's why, even now, they maybe don't feel music. Maybe they were struggling with something. They needed that to get through, where we want our athletes to be as pure as possible without assistance.
Interesting. Yeah, I'm not sure. I have kind of mixed feelings about that. I kind of tend to admire somebody who's really had to struggle to get to where they are versus, you know, somebody who just has a natural gift and then they can do it because they were born that way. But yeah, I think that's an interesting point, though. So I just want to say I heard the bell ring and I want to thank you all for coming out. And I'll see you maybe later this week. Do a coffee break on Friday and then another presentation on Friday afternoon dealing with film and philosophies. Thanks.
Thank you.